Okay, I'm here with Kevin Harris, who does sociology at Princeton University in the Department of Near East Studies. Today we're going to be talking about Iran's economy. So it's sanctions are a really big thing, and we hear about them all the time. And Iran's economy is a big thing; we hear about it all the time. But I feel like there's not enough detail and there's not enough nuance to the discussion. So today's conversation will. We'll go through a basic history and then get into sort of how Iran's economy works in sort of the abstract, and then get into sanctions, and then finally sort of focus on, how the election of Rouhani will sort of change this economy if he can, and then end with, how does an average Iranian negotiate the economy? How does, Reza in Tehran deal with, all this, this economic mess. So let me start off with, give us an economic history of Iran, starting with, don't start in the 19th century, of course, but, sort of starting with Rafsanjani and sort of, the post-war period, and sort of walk us through, how has Iran's economy evolved since about 1990, 1992?
Well, because I'm a historical sociologist, I got to start a little bit earlier. Sorry. So, the real question is what happened after the revolution in the economy, and then after, and then during an 8-year war with Iraq, and then after that, how did the Islamic Republic, deal with economic change and challenges? So, like a lot of revolutions, the economy breaks down, as we saw in Egypt in 2011. Some of the economic elites leave. Others are arrested, and the same thing happened in Iran in 1979. So the state, partly by design but really by accident, ended up nationalizing a lot of the big industry in Iran, the banks. Of course, gas, oil, and everything like that was already in the public sector. But a lot of the industrial production was nationalized. Then they had a war with Iraq for 8 years. And as we know about wars, wars also tend to enlarge the public sector, put more control of the economy under the state. This doesn't matter whether it's Iran, the United States, Britain, Russia. Okay, so that was the situation. During the 1980s, that when President Hashemi Rafsanjani came into power as president, in the 89, 90, this was what he and his circle were looking at. And at the time, of course, the East Asian miracle was in full going on at full speed. So you had all of these often Western-trained economists in Iran, but also just sort of, young, slowly turning middle-aged revolutionaries who looked to the East, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, as every country was doing in the Third World, and saying, this seems to be the only way to grow your economy and do it, as a Third World country. There wasn't a consensus in Iran at the time that we should copy the East Asians, but it was a model that Rafsanjani thought, this is something that we should aspire to. So there was an attempt in the early 90s to privatize a lot of the public sector, and the idea being that if we give things over to the private sector, they'll handle production better, they'll be able to increase employment. Even in the end of the war, unemployment was a big problem, as it is today. And they wanted to, of course, integrate with the international financial system, which they had been closed off from after the revolution. So they had a whole sort of set of structural ch package, had a structural adjustment package set up. It was often said that they got this from the World Bank or they got this from the IMF. It's actually not true. They knew what they wanted to do. And the World Bank came along and basically said, if you want to do this, here's the ways you can do it. However, Iran is not just controlled by a single ideological faction or group. The revolution contained many different groups who vied for control of the state, and even after those who surrounded Ayatollah Khomeini ended up running the state, pretty soon after that, by 1983-84, it was pretty clear that there were lots of differences within these new revolutionary elite. So those differences widened during the war, and then with the death of Khomeini, the end of the war, and the sort of attempt to position Iran in a sort of a post-Cold War period, these differences among the elite really just came out into the fore, and we saw the beginnings of the factionalism, which in various forms continues today and has been, of course, exacerbating over the last 20, 25 years. So there were guys like people who now we call reformists, who at the time identified themselves as on the left, as left-wing on economic matters, both foreign and domestic, and they opposed Rafsanjani's structural adjustment programs quite heavily. For a while, they did it from the parliament, and then they weren't in the parliament. They did it via the newspapers, and they said all kinds of nasty things about him, called him a capitalist, called him pursuing Western version of Islam, these kind of things that were the ultimate critiques in the sort of Islamic Republic milieu. He said, no, actually, we want to build a mixed economy. We don't want to build a We don't want socialism. We don't want capitalism, like every third world country said, you know, in the 60s and 70s. We don't want these. We want a third way. But given the fact that there was such schisms in the elite, they never could actually carry through the package as they wanted. That was one reason why the economy never became sort of like, let's say, like Turkey's economy. So Turkey at the same time was privatizing its public sector. It wanted to integrate with the world economy again, get financial loans from big institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. And it wanted to, you know, sort of reduce the size of the public sector. And Turkey was able to do this, and Iran wasn't at the time. I'm talking about the early 90s. And if we can ask why, seems pretty simple. Turkey was invited to do so by big Western institutions. And the U.S. totally had no problem with that. And when Iran tried to do it, they were blocked. So the World Bank wanted to provide long-term financing for Iran's development programs, for its structural adjustment, and had even set up a path for it to do that. And this was blocked by the United States, specifically by the first year of the Clinton administration. So all of a sudden, Iran was stuck in a bind that it was carrying through these you know, liberalization programs, and it couldn't find the financing to basically pay for the change. And all of a sudden, the oil price dropped in 93-94, and they basically had to print the money, print their way out of the problem, and it led to a huge inflationary spike. That was the end of the great Rafsanjani experiment to a certain extent. The second term of Rafsanjani, basically nothing much changed after that. However, you know, there was a set of changes that occurred in the early 90s that, in fact, were important. And one was the government started telling the public sector businesses, institutions, all kinds of groups that, you know, were basically on the government dole, told them, you know what, you're going to have to pay for yourselves now. So you can be in the public sector, but you're going to have to pay for this yourselves. And you said you have to be self-sufficient. So there was some there was a lot of downsizing in the early 90s. There was it generated a layer of subcontracting in the early 90s that, you know, we're going to contract out all these services or in the gas sector or you name it. This is way back in the early 90s. This is in the last 10 years under Ahmadinejad. And there was a sort of an attack on the benefits of the working class that had been built up after the revolution and during the war, protections, labor protections and social protections. So then fast forward 10 years to Khatami's period, and basically, you know, the economic policy of Mohammad Khatami was not very different than Rafsanjani, because the former leftists that I described had softened their ideological stance, rightly or wrongly, softened their stance and called themselves reformists, whatever that means, I still am unclear, but reformists. They decided that, you know, Rafsanjani's economy is a good thing to aspire to, but we have to basically add on a democratization agenda, that you can't, you know, transform an economy without bringing people aboard, and you can't just do it from above, you've got to do it from below. So they added a sort of a civil society discourse to the liberalization programs of Rafsanjani, but in detail, the economic side, things hadn't changed that much. The difference was that the conservatives, again, in the elite, because they hated Khatami so much, they hated the reformist agenda more on the social side than on the economic side. They used this economic agenda as a way to block Khatami. So there were very, you know, ambitious programs on the books in the late 1990s for privatization, for liberalization of the public sector, for integration, bringing in foreign investment, et cetera, all the things that lots of other countries wanted to do at the time. Maybe they worked, maybe they didn't, but, you know, this sort of so-called East Asian model, you know, get Iran off of an oil economy and bring in more industry. And it was blocked. It was blocked at lots of different levels by conservatives. So then we can, after the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, of course, rhetorically, he sounded like he was always doing the opposite of what came before. That's the way he presented himself. But if you actually take a look at what he did, I mean, one, he had the benefit, unlike Khatami and Rafsanjani, of having a massive increase in state revenue thanks to a commodity boom in the 2000s. So he had money to spend. And he basically, you know, he took a look. He's like, what can I do to give me credit? That's basically what he was thinking, is I want to do things to get me credit. So a lot of things he did, and maybe people don't want to hear this, he was just doing what Rafsanjani and Khatami's guides had proposed, but he was just putting his own name on it. So, for example, the huge subsidy liberalization program that he put in place, that had been on the books since 1989-1990, meaning that had been on the agenda since then. The introduction of taxes, which the bazaar, you know, was up in arms about in Tehran, introduction of value-added taxes on goods to get people to pay taxes when they actually, you know, are involved in the economy, that's been on the books on the agenda since the late 80s, early 90s, too. So, you know, to a certain extent, there's actually there's an odd continuity that happened under Ahmadinejad. The difference is that let's just say he also was blocked, by the way, in a lot of different things. And I don't think he realized the shockwave effects of some of the things that he was doing. So, you know, the subsidy liberalization program was such a huge thing. And his idea was, I'm going to do this with all the other things at the same time, banking reform, tax reform, and his version of privatization, which he carried out, and he thought, just like I think the previous guys thought in a weird way, was that we do all this at once and this will be like a magic package. And some people realized rather fast that it's not as easy to do that. So the state has to be a lot more flexible. So anyway, that's the situation Iran is in today, that it's not a state dominated economy by any means. This is a myth. And in fact, you know, like a lot of countries in the global south today, the state is involved in some parts of the economy. In other parts, it's protecting particular national industries. Whether going from India to China to Brazil, they protect some of their national industries. Iran does the same thing for autos, for example. There's a big private sector, but the private sector in the global south is not the classic, like what economists, or I should say bad economists, what they think of when they say private sector, with all the kind of assumptions that goes along with what that's supposed to mean for everything. No, Iran's private sector generally is often tied to the state. They're doing contracts, subcontracts for the state, or they're pursuing avenues that the state has given up on. And that's one of the weird things about the sanctions that, of course, people who apply such sanctions never think about, is that the sanctions have generated a whole new layer of private sector entrepreneurs in Iran, that their whole lives are dedicated to getting around sanctions. And sanctions, in a way, is a perversely, you know, creates all kinds of entrepreneurial spirit because there's a lot of constraints, so people have to be creative. And the government is handing over companies to the private sector left and right because they know that if a state name is attached to these things, they're not going to be able to do business across borders or even you know, across border business. So it's a I don't want to say it's just complex because everything's complex. I do want to say that each of these attempts to liberalize Iran's economy have created a new layer of stakeholders, and it's not like when the conservatives came in power 10 years ago that they cut everybody else out. The economy is too big for that, and it's bigger and bigger and bigger. It's a big economy. So what happened was that, I'll give you an example, banks. I mean, this is a great example. So banks, there was a big expansion of the banking system in the late 90s under Khatami, and they added a bunch of new banks, some in the private sector, some in the semi-private sector. So there was some state investments, there was some private investment. And then under Ahmadinejad, they added more banks. So now there's about probably 12, maybe 10 to 12 banks in Iran right now that have branches everywhere and have different names. Who owns these banks? Well, some of them are classic sort of public banks. The older ones are public banks. They've been around since before the revolution. Some of them are owned by big pension funds. They are owned by the pension fund, like the Social Security pension fund in Iran, or the auto industry pension fund has money in some of these banks, investment in the banks, the army, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Another one is owned clearly by guys who were close to Rafsanjani. And they, you know, they're not in the government anymore. They're in the private sector, and they have ties to one of these banks. Another one is definitely a Khatami linked bank, meaning that the guys who run these banks got their start in the Khatami period. And then there's some who, again, are linked to the new conservative that rose up in the 2000s. So there's a bank that's linked to the IRGC's cooperative fund. There's one linked to the Basij's cooperative fund. There's one linked to Mashrai, which got in trouble recently. Mashrai is the guy who's attached to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So anyway, they're all existing at the same time. They're all participating in the market. And, you know, some healthy competition going on. So I think it's we mistake, you know, the tales of elite battles in Iran. This guy wins, this side wins, that side wins. And we think that that actually manifests itself fully in the economy. But actually, I think in reality, various attempts to shift the economy over the last 20 years have just added layers, which on the one hand presents a lot of places for, you know, guys to hang out in and make money in when they're not in power in the state. On the other hand, it makes it much more difficult to regulate the economy. And, you know, just because you have a big state doesn't mean that you have a very you have big state capacity. So regulating the economy, making sure that let's just say, for example, I mean, just, you know, that workers are paid minimum wage, that that people are paying taxes on their economic activities, all the kind of things that we take for granted. Well, we used to take for granted in wealthy countries. In the third world, it's not a fait accompli. A big problem of state formation is regulating the economy. It's not getting out of the economy. That's the myth. You know, the myth is that the state's in the way of the economy, and once it gets out, the market will naturally provide economic growth. And that's not – I don't think any serious economist ever would admit that or ever would say that. In reality, what should happen and what has happened, let's say in China, for example, is that the state increases its regulatory power over the market. And Iran's been trying to do that actually for about 20 years. And so hopefully, you know, that will be on the agenda of Rouhani.
Interesting. So let's break it down a little then. You know, who are, you know, in terms of who are the key actors in this economy? You know, you've touched on, you know, in your remarks, you've already sort of touched on, you know, the banks, you know, Khatami, Rafsanjani, but let's sort of expand it. You know, where do we put the clerics in general? So, you know, religious funds, banyads, or however you pronounce that. And, you know, where do we put that in relation to the IRGC, the CEPAL, and then the Bazaar, and then the Bastille. And then, you know, in addition to the actors, you know, where do we put certain factors? You know, where do we put oil, corruption, and in this point that you've already touched on, regulation or the lack thereof? I mean, you know, how do you know, elaborate further? I mean, you know, what is the relationship and what is sort of guiding this relationship between these actors and, you know, these factors too?
Well, we need to first demythologize some of these phrases. You know, the idea that the economy is run by a single clique, a single organization, a single network. That idea has always been present in Iranian political discourse. I mean, actually, you know, I mean, you know, Iranians like to say that they're run by a mafia, that the economy is run by a mafia, an oil mafia. The funny thing, you know, it's interesting. When you go to any country in the third world, generally the complaint is that we're being run by a mafia. Brazil, they say we're run by a mafia. Syria, Turkey, you know, China. The word mafia is actually a word that people just like to use to complain that, of course, they don't have access to power and that, you know, that they think that there's something opaque going on at the commanding heights of the economy, and often there is. But that's not a very good way of actually understanding the economic structure. That's sort of a alleyway talk, you know, Kuche Bazari talk, which is fine and it's understandable, but if you want to take it seriously, then you can't rely simply on political discourse to understand economic structure. The problem is that we have unfortunately been doing that for the last probably 25 years. So in the mid-90s, there was a narrative that came out of Iran by the left, who was critiquing the state, saying that, you know, all of the economy is in the hands of these religious foundations. And these are foundations that some of them were set up after the revolution, and they ended up being given a fair amount of property, industry, land, etc. And they operated these things with pretty easy credit, and they put the money back into themselves, and the people that ran them were doing well. And the idea was that this was supposed to be run for particular people. Was this the only part of the Iranian economy? No. But because this looked sexy and strange, I mean, it looks strange to Western analysts who think that the private sector and the state sector are supposed to be two different things, that this became the narrative. And I remember when I first started being interested in Iran, I read about these things called bunyads, these religious foundations, which, you know, in the Middle East have a long pedigree. And every time I went to any talk at D.C., someone was like, what about the bunyads? What about the bunyads? Somebody raised their hand, and if they considered themselves the Iran expert, they made sure to bring up the bunyads. Well, it turns out they're still around, by the way. They own some hotels, they own some land, you know, they own some soft drink companies. But they don't dominate the economy. In fact, they're one more layer of the things I was talking about. Well, so this sort of single bullet way of looking at the Iran economy continued afterwards. So it went from thinking about religious foundations running everything to under Ahmadinejad, the idea that either the leader ran everything, that he had this huge economic fund. And people often claim, I mean, you know, diaspora opposition dissident types like to claim that he's like a multi-billionaire with all of his money sitting in Switzerland and things like that, which is fine. That's what oppositions are supposed to say. They're supposed to present that way. But we don't know, actually. What became the prevailing discourse in the last 10 years was that the economy was being taken over by the paramilitary organizations of the state. So the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which started in 1979, was important in the war. And the Bastille, which is another sort of, zealot, highly zealous Boy Scout club in Iran. So, I spent some time looking into this thing because I was interested in the economy, and I tried to look, do these guys, is this really a coherent organization that runs the economy, that dominates the economy, that it drives at the economy as a whole? And I found that actually, no, that they have groups, or they have, if a guy retires from the military and moves to Virginia, Arlington, close to where you are right now, and basically he sits on the board of a company in the private sector, and they have this guy on there because they know that with this guy on the board, they're going to get the contracts from the state. Does that mean that that company runs that industry? Or does it mean that the relationship between state and private sector can often be rather nebulous? I think, you know, that seems to be the case. Even religious foundations. The biggest landowner, aside from the federal government of the United States, is the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church is a huge landowner in the Southwest. It also has factories. It makes a lot of weird Mormon food. It makes that underwear that Mormons wear. It has radio stations. It has a newspaper. It has its own Social Security fund. Okay? We don't look at that and say, oh, that's so weird. There's a religious foundation that's hugely involved in a part of the American economy. We just say, no, actually, the American economy is complex, and we've generated, you know, social strata that then got involved in the economy. Well, the revolution did that. It generated a whole different set of social groups that, after a generation, started to get involved in the economy in different ways. And so the bazaar is a separate issue, because the bazaar is often, and this was the original silver bullet for understanding Iran, that, you know, really the bazaar runs all the economy, and that's why Iran is this, Iran is that, Iran is that. But actually, we know quite well right now that the worst thing that ever happened to the bazaar as a group, as a social group, basically as a bunch of traders and merchants in urban areas, in cities in Iran, the worst thing that happened to them was the revolution. Their best decade was the 1970s. The first thing that the state did was take away half their business and then pick some winners and losers inside the bazaar and help them out. But the bazaar as a social group has never prospered since the revolution. It's a myth that the bazaar runs everything, you know. So anyway, I would stress my layered, my sort of seven layer analysis of the Iran economy, how many layers of dip you want. But, you know, that's the better way to understand it. It's not as if particular organizations don't have clout. They do, but are they doing things by themselves? And what that implies is a different thing. So the implication that in the last 10 years, the economy has become under control of the IRGC, which you hear a lot, you read a lot. I still read it in the Financial Times, and they should know better because they have somebody there. They should know better. But it's a sexy thing to say, and it percolates all the way up to the policymakers in Washington, D.C. It makes it very easy, by the way, when that's the picture of the Iranian economy, to put sanctions on things like the auto industry. Because if the auto industry, if some section of them or some parts supplier or part of the stock of the auto industry sold on the Tehran stock market is owned by a cooperative pension fund linked to the IRGC or linked to Basij or linked to the army or linked to whoever, then I can draw a line in D.C. and say, these guys are this is in the hands of the bad guys. And so sanctioning this huge industry, which employs 700,000 people in Iran, used to, I don't know anyone, sanctioning them, that's actually hitting the bad guys. That's the problem. You know, it's not just that we're getting wrong how to look at Iran's economy. It has real consequences when we spend all our time exaggerating the influence of one particular actor or another in this very complex economy, which has been well integrated with its neighbors, with the region, since the 90s, if not the 80s, at least by the 90s. And to say that the whole thing is in the hands of one particular clique, either they're being disingenuous or they're being willfully ignorant.
So let me ask you then, how would you conceptualize government ownership in this sort of model you've laid out? I mean, is the government of Iran still picking winners and losers? And then moreover, you know, what are the sort of the key industries that the government of Iran would see itself involved in? I mean, is it just a matter of sort of, you know, telecoms, oil, or is it, you know, sort of deeper? Or is it really truly sort of, you know, laissez-faire, that the government really doesn't have a hand in the economy and it's, you know, mostly private actors or even what you describe sort of pseudo-private, sort of going in between the government and sort of private ownership?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not laissez-faire, but that has very little to do with the fact that it's Iran. Like I said earlier, your average country in the global South, whether it's prospering or not, has rather dense linkages between the state and various business actors. And we can go from Latin America to Sub-Saharan Africa to East Asia, and you can find tons of examples of successful business state, you know, conglomerates. That's the Japanese model. That's the Korean model. So, you know, the fact that you see that in Iran, if you don't know anything about the global South, then you can look at Iran, like many Iranians, and say, this is perverse. This is perverse. It doesn't look like Switzerland, you know. But actually, I tend to think that that's overstressed. I just want to put that out there. So the big sectors of the economy, especially the ones that, you know, Iranians get very sensitive about, things like oil and gas, they're called mother industries in Iran, and they were designated in the 1979 Constitution as supposed to be in the hands of the public sector, as with a lot of industry. This was part of the nationalization process that happened in the revolution, and it was put in the Constitution that the state should own the most important sectors of the economy, but it shouldn't run everything. And it said that, but it left the language pretty vague, let's put it that way. So over the last 35 years, there's been a battle over what should be in the hands of the state, what shouldn't, and what does that mean? And of course, they say two weird things in Iran, which I guess they're honest about. You know, there's the public sector, and then they have this, and then they have the private sector, and then they have a cooperative sector, which there's cooperatives in Iran, like, just like credit unions in the United States. And then they have this thing called the non-governmental public sector, which is things like pension funds that I mentioned, big pension funds, some of these banks that are semi-public. They're in the non-governmental public sector, and they've been allowed to take or be given lots of public sector companies, partly because the government owes them a lot of money. The government has owned the pension fund in Iran, or the big pension fund in Iran, and the Social Security fund in Iran. It owes them now billions of dollars. It's owed them billions for a while. Even in Khatami, it owed them money. And the law was changed so that it could give them companies instead of paying them. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's not just Iran. In Korea, the same thing happens in the pension fund as well. That pension funds are given companies, or at least given shares on the market in lieu of the debt that the state owes them. So I would say that in all of these different major sectors of Iran, so telecom, public utilities, consumer goods, capital goods like cement, you know, Iran has a huge cement industry, pharmaceuticals, transportation and construction, and then, of course, oil and gas, and even in the auto sector, too. All of them. I mean, I can't think of one that I could say that this is dominated by the state any longer. I think that this mixed and layered, often contracted or subcontracted system, which originated, you know, in smaller parts of the economy, have spread to the economy as a whole. And in that sense, you know, it actually reminds me of China, because China has these sort of mother industries, but it allowed for market competition, not necessarily fair, but competition from below to influence particular sectors. But that didn't mean that the Chinese state was absent. It was still there. I'm not saying that the Iranian state has as much capacity as the Chinese state does, but the Chinese state built its capacity. It didn't have it, you know, in the early 80s, it built it. So in that sense, that's what the economy looks like to me. That's what it looks like, by the way, to businessmen who are trying to make a buck. They know that there are lots of different ways to get involved in particular sectors. It's just not the way it looks to D.C., because the D.C. is not trying to understand, and this is my opinion, that, you know, what's the incentive for someone to write a big, long report about Iran's economy, and the outcome of that report is that, you know what, it looks like the rest of the world. It's not news that's going to sell. So instead, you just focus on Iran, you use all kinds of weird numbers to inflate the importance of particular groups, you tie them vis-a-vis weird guilt by association linkages to bad guys, the few bad guys that are already reported in the news, and you say that these guys run everything. It makes it very easy to sanction lots of things that are basically just extraneous to you know, the kind of sectors that supposedly these sanctions are designed to target. And it actually has a feedback back onto Iran, because there's Iranians who read, you know, the Western news. And if someone in the West is saying that the Bonyads are important, well, then they must be, because the West is smart. If someone in the West writes that the IRGC is running everything, then they must be, because the West, you know, they're the ones that know how to look at economics, right? So it has a very weird feedback loop into Iranian political debate. It's not just on economics, it's on everything, this feedback loop. But on economics, I notice it a lot, and it prevents Iranians themselves from actually asking the right questions. The businessmen are different. The businessmen know how to make money, so they know what the economy looks like. But on the side of analysis, I think that we have a problem now inside Iran as well as outside.
So let me ask you then, let's just, you know, cut to the meat of the issue then. Where do we put sanctions? I mean, you know, I think a sort of cursory glance at the legislation and what's already on the books, I mean, it seems like you've targeted oil, central bank, oh gosh, what else? Just about everything. I think the joke between me and a couple of Iranian friends is that, you know, the only thing left, you know, to sanction in Iran is the China and the parakeets.
My joke was that the only thing they had to sanction left was the ice cream.
But I mean, you know, away from, you know, humor, I mean, talk to us about in a political economy setting. I mean, has sanctions really, you know, has it affected the economy? A and B, I mean, what sort of new actors are sort of emerging out of this adjustment? I mean, has it really just created a generation of people who are just saying, who shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's a set of constraints, you know, I got to go out and get money anyway. I mean, how does this work? I mean, what does this look like?
Well, sanctions at some level have been around a long time. So it's not a question of – it's a question of degree. And so it's no – I mean, there's no question that a segment of the economy exists because of the presence of sanctions. That's been the case for a long time. I mean, you have two questions. One, you're asking me what would be better sanctions, and I'm not going to answer that question because in my opinion, there's no good answer to that question. Sanctions have so many, according to their own purveyors, have so many different logics. They think it's going to improve human rights. They think it's going to drive democratization. They think it's going to empower the good guys and disempower the bad guys. They think it's going to shift the logic of the bad guys. They think it's going to shift the logic of the good guys. You know, they think that it's going to cause a revolution. The crazy version, but unfortunately it's the common version, but the crazy version of sanctions logic is going to squeeze the people so bad that they're going to overthrow the government, which of course clearly they did not do in 2013. They instead had a democratic election. So I don't want to, you know, you're going to have to ask the people who design these things to justify them, because to me it looks like a rat's nest. And now that it's there, you know how hard it is to untangle a rat's nest. It's really hard. So that's a separate issue. Inside Iran, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say I know how everything is working in Iran vis-a-vis sanctions, because the whole idea is that they don't tell you. Because they don't tell you because, one, it's a national security issue. Like, why should the Iranian government tell me or a journalist how much money they have left in their foreign exchange reserves? They're not. Because the minute they say that, somebody in Congress is going to say we have to hit them harder. So lots of information is now hidden, including statistics about the economy. We can't trust them, and they probably don't want to say some of these statistics because they know it's going to be used as a weapon. And that's the situation it is right now. On a micro level, I've met lots of different people who I've been personally surprised that they've been able to get around these restrictions, whether vis-a-vis finance, types of goods, things like that. But, you know, one has to admit, and we should admit, you know, and the government eventually admitted about a year ago, that the last, like, two successive waves of sanctions, so the unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States and the EU outside of the UN Security Council, they totally caught Iran by surprise. I think Iranian conservative elites have been believing their own rhetoric a little bit too much, that they were really resisting all these things, that this thing was producing some kind of self-sufficiency outcome. And so the financial, you know, the finance is the lifeblood of the system. And the strictures on finance had a huge impact, not necessarily on the foreign exchange reserves, but on the expectations of everybody, which is, of course, all of a sudden everybody tried to get out of the currency, and it had a huge pressure on the currency. I was in Iran at that time, and it was nuts. Everybody was getting out of rials, whether from the housekeeper to the millionaire, and getting it into gold and dollars. So it put a huge pressure on the central bank. On the oil sanctions, you know, I mean, it's bad, right? I mean, they've cut their oil in half. They're down to basically the kind of production levels they were doing during the war with Iraq, in terms of barrels per day. Luckily, the price of oil is quite high, so, unlike in the 1980s. So you know, the price of oil has, to a certain extent, not to, but alleviated the true attempt to just destroy Iran's economy by some of the design of some of these sanctions. But clearly, this is not—it's not a sustainable situation. If the economy shrank by 25%, it would be sustainable. But it's not, you know, that would be horrible. That would be horrible. You know, estimates last year of how much the economy went shrank is between, it depends who you ask, between 1 to 5% negative growth. That's basically what happened in Europe after the 2008 crisis, you know, like Spain and Ireland and places like this. So it's bad. It's not poor. It's not disastrous yet, but it's not a sustainable situation. There has to be some kind of shift. So this is the situation that the Rouhani guys are in right now. And they have huge domestic constraints because of the fact that, you know, given the good times under Ahmadinejad, the guy ramped up spending on everything. And the budget ballooned. And it didn't always balloon in ways that we know about, too. But it didn't always balloon in a very responsible way. So when the good times were over and the revenue stopped coming in, well, we have this big budget deficit now in Iran. So the one of the first things that they're going to do, Rouhani's going to do, is basically present a new budget. This is what new presidents do in Iran. So we're going to see that. And given the sort of ideological background of Rouhani, which is sort of this liberal guy, you know, he's got a lot of liberal economists around him, I think it's going to be a very austere budget. And he's going to blame Ahmadinejad, but he's going to, you know, cut a lot of things inside the country. That's going to work maybe for a while. Again, then they won't have to print as much money. The idea is to bring down inflation. But still, this is not an economic problem. It's a political problem. So, you know, the question is, how do they get out of this mess? How do they get out of this rat's nest with the United States and the EU, with all these unilateral layers of sanctions added on for all the different reasons I stated, and still be able to salvage whatever kind of political coalition that came out of the 2013 election? It's not going to be easy. Maybe if anybody could do it, he could do it, because it seems like he's well-placed and he was in the right places at the right times in the last 20 years. But this is why a lot of people, even after the election, are not very hopeful, because that's the kind of constraints that he faces.
I mean, what do you see as this, not the source, but I mean, is it really sanctions that it's constituting all of Iran's, you know, economic problems? I mean, you know, where do we put corruption? Where do we put, you know, internal factors? I mean, it seems like, you know, Rouhani not only has to sort of, you know, bring to bear a budget of austerity or whatever, but also it seems like he has to deal with, you know, internal corruption. I mean,
look. There's lots of different types of corruption. I think, you know, sitting in the United States, you know, reading Econ 101, or, you know, working on my NGO, or you know, listening to NPR, you know, we have this thing of corruption is bad. Corruption pervades the third world, and that's what's dragging all the economies down. That's why they're not wealthy like us. I think that is basically I think it's pretty naive. I don't think anybody's actually worked with the economies in maybe even in the North, but in the global South, they probably think differently about varieties of corruption. Okay, so look, the South Korean economy in the 1960s was incredibly corrupt. It was just the kind of corruption that produced economic growth. There's all this old joke in the development field that that the East Asian miracle had corruption that produced bridges, and the Sub-Saharan Africans have corruption that doesn't produce bridges. But they're both corrupt. So I think the discourse of corruption is a political discourse, especially in a revolutionary or post-revolutionary state, where part of the ideology of the revolution was that there's going to be a more egalitarian distribution of income. There's going to be, some like public modicum of justice, that, elites aren't going to be able to do what they want to do. This is the same thing in China, same thing in a lot of post-revolutionary societies. So in this kind of society where, the very essence of the revolution is supposed to be about justice, and about egalitarianism, well, clearly when the hangover comes and society's, revert back to the old ways in their own way. Yeah, one of the best ways to attack the state, even if you're in it, is to say there's corruption all around me. But as someone who has dealt with the Iranian state at the micro level in lots of different ways, it's not the most corrupt place in the world. It's probably not even near the bottom, like third. The public sector in Iran, I'm always much how surprised how well it works. It doesn't work great. It's not, but compared to Pakistan, for example, just compared to Pakistan, ask a Pakistani to travel to Iran and then ask him or her what he or she thinks about the public sector, the transportation system, what kind of corruption happens at the daily level, and they will tell you, I would imagine they'll tell you that it's nowhere near as bad as it is in Pakistan. So, I don't think corruption's ever an answer to anything. On Rouhani, what his internal problems, this is the problem that Ahmadinejad, he tried a lot of things out. He was an experiment. He experimented on a lot of stuff. He didn't ask advice from a lot of people. He just went ahead and did it. And on some of them, he took the ideas of his predecessors and just ran with them. So he merged a bunch of ministries. He again tried to implement taxes. He got rid of subsidies. He implemented a cash grant income program. He lifted tariffs on all kinds of imports, things that the liberals had been saying, do this for such a long time, we want free trade. He lifted imports, lifted protection imports, and guess what? Big destruction in the Iranian economy, among textiles, among agriculture, et cetera. So, I do hope that Rouhani and the sort of the liberal center-left coalition that has carried him into power, I hope that they take a much more sort of empirical look at the Iran economy and say, how do we support the kind of sectors of the economy that will produce both growth as well as, produce employment? Because that's a huge problem in Iran's economy right now. Oil generally doesn't employ a lot of people. It generates a lot of revenues, but doesn't employ a lot of people. So hopefully they'll take a piece-by-piece look. I think that they can do that. But the rhetoric, again, the rhetoric has to be seen as a political, as part of a political debate. So to argue that Ahmadinejad was a statist, a populist, that he was the one who he took over all the economy, to say that, well, there's an element of truth in that. Part of it is just the fact that there were lots of revenues coming into the state. But to say that is a part of a political battle. And I think that we're naive when we read like the Iranian newspaper and we say that, well, the reformists say that the other side is doing all these things. And then we say, and that's the end of the story, because the reformists themselves, they've been changing their economic discourse for 25 years. They don't admit it. So I think we're naive to take a look, not perceive Iranian economic debates as part of an internal political debate, and that includes over sanctions as well.
So, let me ask a question about Rouhani specifically. What was sort of the underlying factors that sort of, allowed him to get elected? It seems like by all indications, he was very much an insider. In our discussion with Dr. Fahy the other day, the way that she described him, if I remember correctly, is that he's an insider. He's a guy that who spent more time, among political circles rather than sort of, being visible to the population. But, what were some of the reasons that he got elected? Is it purely, in term, is it purely economical that, or is it purely a matter of economics and sort of his campaign making an economic argument? Or is it, you know, what are the other factors?
Well, if that was the case, then they were all making, everybody said that they wanted to improve the economy. That's what you say when you want to get elected. Whether it was from the middle-of-the-road conservatives running in Iran, like Mayor Ghalibaf, to former IRGC head Mohsen Rezai, they all say that they were going to improve the economy, bring in good management, be technocratic. They all say the same thing. And Rouhani said this as well. So I think that that is not the best way to read things. It's not like he was running against a bunch of people who said, we're going to continue the policies of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad because it's been great. No, they all, the whole election was running against the president to a certain extent. He won because of a couple things. One was that over the last 8 years, the right wing has dominated Iranian politics, but in the process has divided itself far more than it was in the 90s when it was opposing, the right wing was opposing Mohammad Khatami and the reformists. So they got rid of him. They got, the right wing got into power and said, okay, we're running things now. And instead of that creating a sort of a solid authoritarian network of elites, it resulted in an implosion of the right wing. I mean, they imploded. I mean, we can go into why, but that's basically what has been happening in Iran the last 6 years. Before 2009, there was already lots of divisions. But 2009 and the Green Movement and the election controversies basically punched a huge fist into the right wing. And maybe for about 6-7 months, it looked like they were unified. They pretended to look unified. But when I was living in Iran at the time, the first thing I realized after 2009, after the election, was that the right wing is divided. I could tell it, and it just got worse and worse and worse over the next 4 years. So that was a situation that they weren't all running on the same team. They were all running against each other. They thought that the other side was kaput, that the reformists and guys around Rafsanjani had basically been emasculated politically, and that, you know, they had control over the state institutions. But, you know, it's a testament to both the reformists this time, who for the last, I think, year and a half have really focused on how to get back into Iranian politics and what's the most pragmatic, meaning, and most, and by mean that meaning most effective way to get back into Iranian politics. By them, I mean, they call themselves reformists, by the way. They're not revolutionaries. So they want to enter politics and change it, change the system. That's the definition, I think, of what they call themselves. And they've done that. They used to not be like that, by the way. I mean, the reformists in the 90s were super intellectuals. They were haughty. They didn't really talk, they didn't really connect that much to society, to, you know, lower rungs of society, even though they were from the left, but that doesn't mean much. And, you know, they talked a good game about civil society, but, you know, many of them, not just Rouhani, spent their time, you know, in think tanks and intellectual circles and places like this. So they've changed. Part of being in the wilderness for 8 years is that you have to take a hard look at, you know, all the things that you did wrong. And they did that, I think, to a good extent. Many of the most sort of radical liberals in the late 90s today are very moderate guys. It's not like they didn't change their intentions. They still want a particular type of Islamic Republic, a democracy, a religious democracy, an Islamic Republic with the human face, whatever you want to call it. That's the goal. But they've really become more pragmatic about how they're going to do it because they were out of power, and that tends to chasten you. So that's what happened on the elite side. And then on the social side, you know, again, we always underestimate the power that parts of Iranian society have over the state. I think we've underestimated it for 30 years, 35 years now, whatever. Iranian society is powerful. Parts of Iranian society are very powerful. It's not the groups that we think. We think that the Iranian government relies on all the poor people, that it dupes them, it gives them money, it gives them religion, it spoon feeds them all these things, and then the poor people are the ones that really the state relies upon. That's hogwash. That is not the way Iran works. That's a myth that both, of course, some Iranian liberals like to say, some people in the opposition like to say, but mostly it's just what people in the West say, because we don't understand how Iranian politics works. The Iranian state spends way more money on the middle class than it does on the poor. It's just a number. I mean, it spends more money on the middle class in terms of education, in terms of welfare, healthcare, social security, transportation, you name it. All that stuff, urban policy, all the stuff that all the improvement of cities is directed at the middle class. So the middle class has a lot of power in Iran, and it uses it. It's not as use it as a coherent whole often. But clearly what happened in this election was that these reformists and some of the guys around Rafsanjani, for various reasons, got wind that people actually wanted to vote again. That 2009 was a catastrophe for them, but there was a demand. Oops. Sorry, man. There was a demand for a candidate. I'm a busy man, sorry. There was a demand for a candidate in Iran that represented change, and they were going to vote for that candidate. So once the reformists got wind of this, about 3-4 weeks before the election, they applied this pragmatism in a very ruthless fashion, and they didn't allow anybody to disagree. We have to remember that every Iranian election since the Khatami era, so 2005 and 2009, the reformists didn't have a single candidate. They didn't have a coalition candidate. There were multiple reformists running against each other. And what kind of when you have the odds stacked against you, the conservatives dominate a lot of the state. Why would you run multiple candidates? They did. They did twice. Even in 2009, you had two guys running on the left, on the center left. So this was the first Iranian election where the reformists and the centrists and sort of moderate guys got together and said, okay, we want to encourage as much participation as possible, and we want to make sure that we have the maximum advantage of at least getting into the second round of the election. And we know that there's demand for voting because people have told us this. So let's get our act together and do that and figure out who has the best chance of winning or at least doing well. And what can we do to make that happen? And they did it. They did it in 3 weeks, and they did it without anybody knowing about it that much. And by the time that they had basically secured the candidacy of Rouhani and they got the other guy who was running to step down, by the time that happened, it was basically a week before the election, the conservatives were not ready. They had no idea that the reformists were this organized and this pragmatic. And they essentially got locked into a dilemma that if any of the conservative candidates would have pulled out, because there were too many of them, and they were all based, running on their personality, not on their ideology. If any of them had pulled out, some of their votes would have gone to Rouhani. So it's a myth. It's a myth that the leader or some, guy behind the curtain was really controlling the election the whole time and just, duped people into voting. Again, that goes into the hogwash category. Iranians themselves like to say that sometimes. But, Iranians say a lot of contradictory things. Doesn't mean everything they say is always true. This is a case where supply and demand worked quite well in Iran. Demand for a candidate that represented the best possibility for change. If that could have been one that the reformists supplied, all the better. And then the supply was that the reformists were ruthlessly pragmatic in the way that they entered the political game this time. They recognized the rules of the game, and they played those rules. They didn't decide that there was another game they wanted to play, a game about discourse, about dialogue, about I'm okay, you're okay. That clearly didn't work last time. So this time they played the game by its own rules, and they won. So this is a huge shift. For people who watch Iranian politics and been watching it for a while, this is a huge shift. And this is why people are optimistic. The optimism comes from the fact that the reformists are not going to play the political game the way they used to. And so if that's the case, that they can manipulate the game better than their conservatives can, then that's a reason to be optimistic about domestic change in Iran.
I mean, does that have a lot to do with? I mean, it seems like that you know, Rafsanjani and Rouhani strike me as both sort of insiders, and not only insiders, but guys who, you know, you can't really describe them as ideologues, but rather really pragmatist guys. I mean, is that?
Yeah, but what is, I mean, this insider discourse, like, that I was in Iran when the election happened. So the first thing I turn around and read the Western news, and they're all like, this guy's an insider. This guy's a you know, in the inner circle. I think the insider talk, again, I mean, I'm optimistic because he's an insider. But this insider talk, I think, you know, is a compensation by Western Iran analysts who got it all wrong. I would say, you know, they're all insiders, man. I mean, look, the definition of an outsider for someone who goes on and on about Rouhani as an insider, the definition of an outsider would be someone who wants to end the Islamic Republic. And clearly, nobody in Iran who's running for president of Iran is going to self-destruct the system. They might accidentally destroy the system, but they won't do it intentionally. So I don't understand. I mean, to claim that this guy's an insider, I don't think that gives you any insight into what's going on in Iran. His particular biography is very useful, right? His biography as an elite is useful, but so are the biographies of the rest of them. You know, Khatami was an insider. Insiders in Iran often get kicked out. So insiders in Iran also often try to change the system. I think that gives us very little grasp of what it means. And, you know, this funny thing, Rouhani was, you know, a bad guy in the 1980s or a bad guy in the 1990s, and that's why he's a bad guy today. Well, look, they were all bad guys, if you believe this, and they were all revolutionaries. They all were in the state in the 1980s when lots of horrible things happened, as in the end of the 1990s. And yet we can differentiate between reformist elites and guys like Rouhani. They've all tempered their biographies. You know, they've all had a hell of a life. You know, they've all had this huge transformational shift. Some of them have become hardened as a result. Some of them have gone through huge self transformations, and some have gone through minor self transformations. So I don't know. I mean, Rafsanjani himself, even before the revolution, was known as a sort of, you know, not a very ideological guy. Rouhani, you know, Rouhani, look, he's got best of both worlds. He's a cleric and he's a PhD, you know. He's got the ultimate in credentials in Iran, and he's embedded in lots of different networks because he's a survivor. And I would say that the fact that, you know, the what happened after the election was that all sides all of a sudden claimed that he was one of them. You can call that being an insider if you want. But to me, that's one reason why I'm optimistic. Because the first thing that happened after the election was not that the right wing said, this guy's the enemy and his election is going to be a disaster for Iran. They didn't say that. A couple of them got a little bit melodramatic about it. But really, here's what they're saying right now in the newspaper, saying, you know what, actually, he's a conservative and he's with us. And so basically, well, we won the election after all. And what does that mean? It means that they're trying to figure out how to play the new political game. They're not playing the old game of, like, let's destroy the guy. And that's great. If you can actually get parts of the right wing in and normalize them into institutionalized politics, to where somebody does something you don't like in the state, you don't just destroy them. That's what happened in the 90s, and that's what happened in the 2000s. So if they're all claiming he's one of them, I think this is a great sign, as opposed to they're claiming that he's an enemy, that he's, you know. So they all want to be part of the new administration. So Rouhani has a lot of power, actually. It's not like he has no power. He has lots of power. Everybody's demanding that they be on board so that they get, of course, a say in what happens next. So he can use this to his advantage. It's not going to last forever, because the minute things start going bad, he's going to take a lot of heat. But in the meantime, I think he can be pretty crafty in the way that he reconstructs the alliances and networks among the elite in a way that allows him to accomplish his agenda. And if you've listened to his speeches since the election, to me, his agenda seems pretty radical, actually. as far as it goes. I mean, as far as the possibilities in Iran.
How would you describe his agenda specifically then? I mean, if it's, you know, if you consider it to be radical, I mean, you know, how would you describe that to the audience? I mean, is it?
Yeah, well, okay. So radical doesn't mean I'm going to pull the plug on the Islamic Republic. So for some people, that's what radical means. For me, it doesn't mean that. So radical is the wrong word, perhaps. I say radical is basically, it seems to me that he wants to not only on the social cultural side recreate the environment of the late 90s, but he wants to actually institutionalize that. It never was institutionalized in the late 90s. So that's newspapers, media, internet, these kind of things. Free speech and all these kind of things. It's I think again, if he constructs, he has to get and maintain power first, and then we'll see what's possible. On the economic side, you know, this is where we have to be a bit more careful because, you know, yeah, getting into the sanctions clearly is an important priority. But then, what to do with that if it happens? I mean, it's still rather slim. But if it happens, what to do? Should the costs of reconstructing Iran's economy, of integrating it integrating it more into the world economy, should the costs of that be borne by the poorest of Iran? I don't think so. But unfortunately, I don't see a way in which workers and rural peasants and people like that have a say in the state. Especially the way that the policies are being presented. I could be wrong. The House of Labor, sort of the corporatist union in Iran, claimed that it delivered, you know, millions of votes for Rouhani. One of the many, many people who said, nah, he's one of us, after the election. So maybe, that's my sort of weird, I feel a little bit weird about that. We'll see what happens. But on the other hand, you know, the solidification, institutionalization of political rights will allow for increased protest by those without power. So that would be the upside, is that, you know, people can – there's already lots of protests going on in Iran by workers, by civil servants. We just don't read about it in the West because for the West, we want to look at protests by middle-class people, by students, the kind of things that we think look like us. But we don't report on workers' protests in the United States either. So why would we report on them in Iran? But actually, if you read the Iranian newspaper, it's actually rather – basically every month there's probably at least 10 to 20 labor protests somewhere around the country, way more than any kind of student unrest. And there's this huge, big waves of labor protests in Iran, and they make radical demands on the state. The state's promised them all kinds of things in terms of pension benefits and welfare promises. That's part of the Revolutionary Compact, and the state is not delivering on them. So there is pressure from below. I don't want to make the point that the poor are totally apolitical and the workers are depoliticized. They're not depoliticized. They're active. If the political game is played at the top over the next few years, that provides a bigger space for these demands from below to be felt, then that's great. That's great. So, but again, the question is unresolved. The social question, the social economic question, is unresolved. Even if we solve these other questions.
Interesting. So, for my last question, I'm curious. You know, we talked a lot about elites, elite-driven processes, and whatnot. You know, how does an average Iranian negotiate all this? I mean, what is daily economic life look like for, you know, Reza out in Tehran, Reza, you know, Ali out in Desful, or, you know, Fadideh out in Tabriz or Kermanshah? I mean, is it, you know, is life harder since, you know, the passage of sanctions? Is it easier? Is it the same? I mean, you know, what does it look like for an average Iranian?
Well, unfortunately, when you average everything, you lose. I think you lose the answer. Some people make money in inflationary situations. When prices go higher for agricultural goods, well, the farmers actually are making more money. They might be paying more money for other things, but you know, so at the end of inflation, it's not, it doesn't have a one single effect on everybody. If you're a fixed wage earner, like a pensioner or a government employee or civil servants, you're, and by law, you know, your wage is supposed to match, at least match inflation. But last year, and this is something, of course, that the guys at Thatcher Rouhani were probably in favor of, last year they didn't raise the wages at the rate of inflation. They raised it about 20%. Inflation was 35%. So for them, they've been taking a big hit the last few years because their income wages haven't been rising as high as inflation has. But people in the informal sector, which means people who do all kinds of things unregulated by the state, some of them make money off of this situation. The problem of sanctions and of inflation is that it just distorts the economy away from things that away from a lot of productive activity. So, you know, when the sanctions are in place, it creates a whole strata of people that their entire job, their entire livelihood is based on moving things around and evading other things. That's not a productive activity. It can be, but generally it's not, especially related to sanctions. So that's the problem. So alleviating these things would probably drive economic activity back into more productive stuff. But you know, people may look. I mean, if you're a construction worker, inflationary booms tend to be good for you because inflation drives up housing prices, and there's a huge demand for housing. People buy and sell at big rates. In the last year in Iran, and so if you're a construction worker, you get employed. So I don't know. I used to think that it was hurting everybody the same way, but when you go to Iran, like, people aren't eating hand to mouth. Some people are doing worse. Other people clearly seem to be doing okay. It boggles the mind actually what they're actually doing behind your back to do fine, but they are. So I don't know. I would say that clearly on the whole, you don't want double digit inflation. They need to get that down. That's bad for, I think, wage earners, anybody who doesn't hold assets. But, you know, I think that, again, it's an untenable situation in the long to medium run. And whether on issues of healthcare or education, clearly sanctions are having a big effect. The quality of healthcare is going down right now in Iran. The access to education outside of Iran is basically cut off, which is where the middle class likes to send some of their kids. So those are things that in the long run will be bad for people's livelihoods. But again, I think we don't know. You know, I mean, from afar, people expected the Iranian economy to collapse. They've been expecting the Iranian economy to collapse for 34 years. And it hasn't. It's you know, there was some probably not wisely planned conference up in Toronto right before the Iranian election that was sponsored by the Canadian Foreign Ministry, which for some reason has decided to become the most hawkish government in North America right now on Iran. So it was going to have this conference on Iran, bring a lot of opposition people, and they had this panel on the economy, and it was a guy from D.C., a guy who claimed he was an economist from Canada, and a person who claimed that she was working for Iranian human rights. They asked them about sanctions. The guy from D.C. said, they're working, and we should double down on them. The economist, or self-proclaimed economist, said, the Iran economy is so bad it's going to collapse anyway, so we don't have to worry about sanctions. It's going to collapse. And the third one, the human rights one, she said, nah, we probably should go to war with them because it's not going to happen fast enough. So that's the range of opinion, by the way, about the Iranian economy, that they see this thing, they hear people complaining, they probably come at it with a huge set of blinders, and they say it's going to collapse, it's a matter of time. And, I mean, that's – even if I wanted the thing to collapse – that's a horrible strategy. That's not a strategy. You know, what kind of activist are you? So I just think that's what feeds into everything that we understand about Iran. I mean, to think that the Islamic Republic is not going to collapse in the next 5 years, just to think that, doesn't matter if you like it or not, if you think that it can be replaced with something better or not, just to think that. To someone in Iran, that sounds like a rather normal assumption to have. Clearly, most people are playing their lives with the understanding that the Islamic Republic is not going to collapse. There's not going to be like an Iraq or a Syria in Iran in the next 5 years. But to say that in polite society in the West, in Washington, D.C., that's taboo. Because we don't have a policy towards Iran that assumes that that system is going to be there for the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. We don't have a policy at all that deals with that fact or even the possibility of that fact. And so the way that we think about the economy is tied to that. You know, it's just tied to that. And so I think that this election, if it showed anything, even if nothing else comes out of it, you know, even if all the expectations are, you know, don't manifest themselves, but basically the reformists just get back in the system and then, you know, they're back in the game. It did show, however, that, you know, even at what clearly was a very dire situation in Iran, the ascendance of the right wing, the increasing strictures on activism, on free speech, on political protest, and then, of course, a huge, you know, juggernaut of international pressure against the country. It didn't collapse. It had an election that produced this crazy democratic outcome. So, you know, it has this. There's a resilience in the Islamic Republic that we don't understand. I personally always find it fascinating, and still don't understand it personally. But that seems to be what's been going on. And so we need to deal with that if we want to make good policy out of D.C. or out of Brussels. I think that would be the first step.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, thanks very much.
Sure.